and I think we're maybe out of the winter now, maybe. This was like springtime for Hitler for a while. To explain a little bit about why I would prefer to not be asked to sign autographs, it gets to be redundant. I have an easy name, you know, Billy Joel, and when I sign autographs now, it doesn't even look like Billy Joel anymore. It looks like Boo. And I'm not even Billy, it's like B. B. Joel, like A. Lincoln, you know? I am glad I'm not, and I have a name like Engelbert Humperdinck, you know? Because that's got to be a real pain in the ass. Can you sign this, Engelbert? Oh, okay. He's probably got a nickname for himself, Hump. E. Hump, you know? But the first time I was asked for my autograph, it was really flattering, and I was thrilled. You want my autograph? Great. Who's it to? What's your middle name? I'll write it to everybody in your family, and I'll write a little poem for you. Happy birthday. And then Billy. And, you know, a big line under the name, an exclamation point, peace sign, XXXXX, hearts, you know, little happy faces and shit, you know. And now, after 25 years, it's sort of like, you know, I will not chew gum in class. I will not chew gum in class. I will not chew gum. I will, will. And you know, another weird thing about signing autographs is if I walk in someplace and all these people want my autograph, I never get to talk to them because I'm too busy signing. So I would prefer to like shake somebody's hand and go, hi, how you doing? Rather than everybody going, autograph, okay, autograph, sign this, sign this. Okay. You know, it takes the time away from being able to actually have a dialogue with people. And I remember once I asked somebody for an autograph. It was Senator Sam Irwin. He was the big old Southern senator during the Watergate hearings. The guy who was just, he was like this real sly fox, and he'd refer to himself, well, I'm just an old country lawyer. And, They got all those guys at Watergate. Sam, Senator Sam is the head of the committee. And I walked onto an airplane and asked Senator Sam Irwin, I went, can I have your autograph? And I thought to myself, I don't believe I just did that. So I took his autograph, I put it in my pocket, forgot all about it, sent the pants out to the cleaners. Pants come back and there's this like white fluffy thing in the pocket. And I realized that was all that was left of poor old Senator Sam. So a lot of times you're going to lose these things anyway. So the thing about the tapes, I would hope that you're not going to try to give me a tape. A lot of people write music, a lot of people sing, and people used to send me a tape. Man, these were bright. This is like a rotisserie. Can you kind of cool them out just a little, like, especially the neurosurgery ones. The white ones, they're like, it's brutal. I'm serious, this is really hot. No? You can't dim them out. This poor guy, he put up this big truss and focusing and he wants to do the lights right. And I'm like, man, wind you. Right? Well, why he's in the wrong business if he doesn't like to be lit, you know? I like to be lit, just not by lights. No, I'm joking. Anyway, so the tape bit. Okay, so people used to send me tapes. I don't know why. They wanted my opinion, and I would write a letter back. You know, okay, good luck, and sounds good to me, and all the best. But the reason I would prefer you didn't give me tapes is, A, I'm not a record company. So if you send me your tape, all of a sudden you're not going to find your tape distributed to record stores all over the world. B, I write my own shit, so I don't need your shit. So, you know, when people send me stuff, I kind of get suspicious. What, are they trying to tell me something? Or, they don't like my stuff, they think I should do their stuff. So, that's the other thing. Now, C, I'm not a critic. I don't pretend to believe I'm a critic. I was brought up, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. So even if I didn't like your shit, I wouldn't say, your shit sucks. What I'd say is, you know, good luck. keep working at it. You know, that kind of thing. And D, I'm tired of getting sued. We live in a litigious society, and like I said, people used to send me tapes, and I'd send the tape back. And I put out my own album, and shortly after I put out an album, I'd get letters from law firms, you know, the letterhead, you know, Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. You know, Dear Mr. Joel, it has come to our attention that you have released a recording with amazing similarities to our client's song that he sent to you, and we have proof that you listened to it, and we find that there is a striking similarity between your use of the word the and his use of the word the, and therefore we feel damaged to $10 million in this. And they got to fight these things, and I win, because I'm not going to just pay these bastards off. I fight it, I win, but then... And then they go, you won. And I go, oh, good. So now, do I get my money back now? Well, no. Well, but I won, but I'm still out the legal fees. Yeah, but you won. I don't get it. If I won, then I don't have to pay, right? But I have to pay. Then you got to fight to recover your money, and this guy don't have any money, so it's whacked. Anyway, so don't give me a pitch, right? Yeah, people come at me sometimes with their things. I see them. I mean, yeah, it's like I see it as a subpoena, you know? And I do these martial arts moves. Who you got? Saying, I was in a Carvel not too long ago, you know, trying to bring spring on, you know? I'll go to a Carvel and bring spring fast enough. I'm standing in the Carvel on the line, this guy comes up, you really have a tape? I want you to have it. And I actually was able to kick the tape right out of the guy's hands. It was the coolest move. I felt like, you know, kung fu, you know? Ah, grasshopper, you know? And I just said, don't take this personally. I don't want your tape. And I yelled at everybody else in the car, you saw that? My foot hardly touched the tape, you know? I didn't absorb any of the tape to my foot. So, anyway, so the other thing was, what was the other thing? Well, one question per customer. It would help things, one, because there may be a number of people who want the questions asked, and obviously I won't be able to get to everybody. When is this loose one? Okay, now, just straighten that part out, and then we complicated all this stuff here. But I don't have to do this, I'm a pro. Okay, what was that thing? Okay, one question, yeah, because, you know, some people, well, I have a two-part question. Well, how did you write this, and when, and why, and will you play it? And I hope that this doesn't turn into, like, one big piano bar, where I do everybody's requests all night, because, you know, I used to do that job. I wasn't that crazy about the job when I was doing that job. You know? Play this, play that. Oh, jeez. So, but I will be playing some songs. I will be playing some of these instruments I have up here to illustrate points about, what is that? I keep hearing clicking. Music, composing, recording, songwriting. Hopefully there are people who might need some technical information about the job I do, because a lot of it is a job. Maybe I can help people to avoid making some mistakes. Avoid some of the pitfalls. I've made every mistake you can make in the music business, but I've survived to tell the tale, so please pick my brain by all means. If you want to ask me about, you know, other stuff, that's fine too, but I'm hoping that the gist of the questions are more about music-related issues. But you want to find out, you know, what happened with me and Christy, you can ask. You know, because I'm curious too. What else? So, I guess the question. So, what else can I say? Yeah. Play some songs. Okay. And, you know, don't. I hope you don't have the idea this is like a Billy Joel unplug. You know, oh, it's Billy unplug. Because I keep getting asked by the people in the record company and these MTV people, the HR, why don't you do an unplug? And I said,
Well, because I'm a piano player. I'm already unemployed.
A little younger. Yeah, I could get more unplugged. I could take a lot of laxatives. I don't want to be that unplugged. So, what else? I'm going to get keyboards, and the thing, and the man. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask them to turn up the house lights so that I can see you. And if you have a question, raise your hand. I'll call on you and ask you if you'll please stand up when I call on you so they know who to give the microphone to. They have wireless mics they'll be walking around with. So if you have a question, please stand up when I point to you. And this is one of these people will bring you a microphone. Okay, let's start over here right in front. This young woman right here.
In your song, Piano Man, had something, John at the Bar, is that John Walker?
John Walker?
Island?
From Long Island? No. No. I don't think so, because the guy behind the bar, I think he was from out west somewhere. He was this big, rangy guy. He looked kind of like, who's that TV star? Tom, Selleck. He looked like Tom. He was, you know, a big, good-looking guy, and he kind of ruddy-faced. But I think he had an accident like that, and nobody from my life would have talked about that. That's not so far as going. So, John at the Bar is a friend of mine. No, he was from L.A. Well, he was living in L.A. But Long Island's funny. A lot of people say that they know me from Long Island. And Long Island is a long island. It's 120 miles long, Long Island. So I run into people, hey, you're from Long Island. Do you know Tony was a Mabuccio? Why would I know? We're from Long Island. Oh, well, sure. You know. It's like millions of people that live there. So I don't know. I'm John Walker. I knew somebody named John Walker. Was it John? Red or black? Okay. So I'm familiar with John Walker. Okay. Let me take another question. So we'll go up to one of the. Worst. Now, you didn't pay any less for those nosebleeds, right? Same price all around? Okay. Cool. Okay, all the way up at the top. There's somebody doing the double-handed method back there. Can you stand up, please? Yes. Hopefully they'll get a microphone over to you. Let's get some microphone walking music. You got it? You don't have a microphone up there? Well, yeah, but I'd like everybody else to hear the question, too. So they'll be there in a second. She, you can pass it over. You can trust people. It's okay. There we go. Okay.
Hi.
Well, I'm also from Long Island, but I'm interested in knowing what your inspiration was for Scenes from an Italian Restaurant.
Okay. So, actually, you can bring the house lights down now for this answer because. Now, just so, can you see me over there? Over by the lights? The light person sitting there by the house light switch? Yes, you can see me? So that's the drill. Like, they'll ask a question, see, and while the lights are on, and then when they finish asking the question, you bring the house lights down again. Okay? Good. You got to work on that. So the question was, Scenes from Time Wrestle. What was the, okay. A bottle of white, a bottle of red, a bottle of rose instead. Okay, obviously I can't really pull off the whole song because this is a keyboard and you need saxophones and all that. So, let's see. A bottle of white, a bottle of red, a bottle of rose. So I'm trying to think. I had to be, let's see, I wrote that 77, mid-70s because I actually used to like rose.
I can't stand this stuff. Well, I could have written that now. It would have to be something else. So,
I've got to think about this like this.
A bottle of wine. A bottle of wine. Obviously, it's two people. They haven't seen each other for a while. They're in an Italian joint. They're drinking white or they're drinking red. Okay, and they're reminiscing. Now, and then the second part of it is that things are okay with me these days. Got a new job, got a good office, got a new wife. Well, that was a while ago. And that was X1.
Yeah. All right.
Family is fine. Okay, so it's two people who got back together. Oh, I remember how this started out. It started out as the middle part. I called originally the Ballad of Brenda and Eddie. It was originally called. It was... debuted this just on its own at the Philadelphia Academy of Music about 20 years ago. And the Eddie and the Pakistanis and the king and the queen of the prom, riding around with the car top down and the radio on. Nobody knows any fine. Always more of a head at the park where guys are. Never knew if you want more than a light. Okay, so the Ballad of Brenda and Eddie was, yeah, well, I can't do the whole thing, but... I saw you, if you're really into it, then you'd be going, oh, he's doing the whole thing, and then I get, ba 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 ba. Ballad of Brenda and Eddie, which was written about the people who were the hero couple in high school. I remember when I was in high school that I used to look up to these people. I used to worship them. I thought the most important thing in the world was to be like them. And the greatest thing in the universe would be to be them. If I could only be as popular as them, if I could only be as, as good looking or as cool as Eddie, if I can only get a chance to go out with Brenda, you know, it was just to be in their universe was the most important thing in the world to me. In school, and now I think about that, my God, my priorities were so screwed up. I went to the reunion, the high school reunion. Well, I didn't go to the 10th year reunion. I was kind of like a beatnik in school. Everybody thought I was going to be a loser, I guess. And I had long hair. You know, I hung out with the hoods. I hung out with the beatniks. I hung out with the collegians. You know, any group that had girls, I wanted to be. I crossed click lines, you know, to meet them. So, about 10 years after the 10-year reunion, I was doing... That night I was doing Saturday Night Live. It was pretty funny. And my dentist. So I went to the 20th year reunion, and I wanted to see what these people looked like. Like the most popular guys and the people I thought were cool. And they had all like shrunken. They had all shriveled up. You know, they looked like crap. You know? And like this guy who had the best pompadour, he had no hair at all. And he just lost it. And this girl I thought was so beautiful, she looked terrible. And I realized that what happened was these people peaked way too early. It's a question of peaking way too early, like you have your whole life. Look, and like all the guys who we thought were nerds and geeks with the slide rule in the pocket, they were all these really successful, or, you know, remember me? Hey, weren't you that geek, you know? Yes, and now I own my own company and I have 20,000 people working for me. You know? I said, wow, what happened? And all the girls who were the wallflowers and shy, and they weren't in the popular group, they blossomed. They looked great. You know, they were sexy looking and they were great looking. I said, wow, this is amazing. Well, you know, the transformation that happens after high school. And essentially, that's what this song was about, was reminiscing about whatever happened to our old heroes. What happens to those people? Whatever happened to? So that was where the lyric came from. Musically, it came from the same place that most of the music I write comes from. I dreamt it. I just dream the stuff when I wake up in the morning singing. I don't know what it's gonna be about, but I think I'll write a song. That's right. Go to the desk, open the book. When I write last week, let's take a look. So it takes a while for me to come up with a lyric. My process is where I always write the music first. 99.9% of the time, I write the music first. And then the process of writing for me is listening to the music and trying to figure out what is encoded in that music. What is the music saying? What's the emotion that's in there? What is the gist of what this music is saying to me? I'll give you an example of a song that I wrote where I wrote the words first, okay? And this will illustrate why I prefer to write the music first, okay? Now, this was a big hit song, okay? So, this is an example of a song where I wrote the words first, okay? And now, the words first song. I will commence now. So I like to write the music first, because music is primary. I believe that music is I know the cliche, it's a universal language, but it really is the human language before we spoke language at all. I know that in the primordial era, cavemen would make a musical noise to ward off, you know, they saw a guy coming into their cave, they would go, or if, you know, you met somebody that you like, you go, you know? And the woman would go, you know, it's just little musical noises. And we recognize this. Everywhere you go all over the world, they understand the language of music. Even instrumental music, where there are no words, there is a story, there is an emotion. It's like, I like to make a little observation about it. My favorite composer is a guy named Ludwig van Beethoven. Okay? I thought he was the greatest composer I've ever heard. Now, he wrote this great stuff, and he only wrote one opera that has words, and he wrote, okay, in the Ninth Symphony, there's which really is based on a poem by Schiller. It's called The Ode to Joy, which is about all men are brothers, and let us rejoice and let us all live in peace. It's a you know, wonderful idealistic poem. But he most of the time didn't write words. So I'm picturing, this is, the part that I'm going to play is from the first part is from this Second Symphony. Okay, so I call this Beethoven's Night Out. Okay. So, Ludwig van Beethoven, he's working away on his symphony, and he goes to the bar, he goes down to the tavern, he needs to take a break. We all need to take a break once in a while. He goes down the street to, I don't know, the pig and boar's head, whatever it is. Okay, the sausage and sauerkraut tavern. Okay, so I must go now and take a break. I go to the bar. Mm-hmm. Bar, and I was chatting up some, you know, German woman, you know, hey, what about the horrible weather we've been having this winter, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she don't want to know about it, you know, she nothing to worry about, she's just drinking his beer, and she's scheiße, nothing, you know, this is not good, I might not go home and walk again, so he goes home, I think I'll work on my second. Nothing's working, nobody's talking to him. Scheiße. They might as well go back and work again. So, I'll do the next part. Didn't do that. Night, he goes out, same thing, puts on the frilly shirt thing, you know, and he does his hair like you see in the bust, you know. He's standing at the bar, he's throwing a bust, you know. Just forget them, you know, and then I'll do the Beethoven bust face.
nothing. Nothing.
A woman I know, but I'm like...
He's again. Symphony is the pastoral symphony. It's a symphony about being in the country, and on the title page, Beethoven wrote, written upon the joy of finding oneself awakening in the country. And I always thought, with who? So, anyway, that was a long answer to a simple question. So, let me take another question. We can bring up the house lights. Okay, now I was all the way up at the top, trying to be democratic about this. So let me get into the middle area here. Alrighty then. Okay, I haven't been, where haven't I been? Right here? Okay, right there. Fine. Yeah. The person pointing at themselves.
Is this my birthday today? And this one gets me happy birthday to me?
That's the question. I believe you. This is the question. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, whatever your name is. Happy birthday to you. Weddings anymore. I don't do sweet 16s. I don't do bar mitzvahs. I don't do birthdays. But I don't like that song. Some of you ought to come up with a new song. What do I got to write? I wrote it up. I wrote it wrong. So, you know, whenever I'm going to write, we're going backwards. But that's okay, we can relax. Whenever I'm in a restaurant, old waiters come over, somebody's bug. Happy birthday to you! And you want to, like, dive through a hole in the floor. All right, let me take another question. Okay, well, that was kind of a musical question, that's a stretch. But let me go into the back area again. Okay, right in there, sort of, there's a guy with an actually forward-facing baseball bat.
Wow!
Let me start a whole new trend. You can pass it down.
I was wondering how it felt like to graduate from high school from 1992, like 20 years afterwards. I was there with you.
You were there? Are you class of 92?
Hey, class of 92. Hey. Is that like an important thing for you to do that?
Is there like a cafeteria right here? Somebody just dropped a tray. Everybody should go, yay! I'm sorry, what was the second? What was the thing?
Is that like an important thing for you to do to get your diploma? From Texas High School?
Well. Let's see. When I didn't graduate high school, my mother's heart was broken. I went all the way to the end. I didn't drop out of school. I went all the way to the end of 12th grade. And I was working at clubs as a musician until 4 o'clock in the morning. In New York, the clubs are up till 4. And, the musician, and school started, you know, you got to get up at 7 o'clock. And who the hell could get up at 7 o'clock working till 4? So I missed a number of days. I missed too many days at school. I passed the test. But I would always show up in school. You know, I had long hair, I had these big buggy eyes, you know. And my eyes were bloodshot because I was tired. That's the only reason. I wasn't doing anything to make them bloodshot, I swear. No, I was just tired. But I looked like I was stoned out of my mind, you know. I just have that look. I look like that now. People love to see my eyes really stoned. I'm not. That's my whole family looks like they're stoned out of their mind. And then, you know, uncles and aunts over in Europe, and hey, they do. They all look like they're stoned out of their mind. But I would go to school and I'd kind of walk around. I was tired, you know, and I got called down to the principal's office and he says, this is 1967. And he says, Joel, you're on pot. That's what you mean, I'm on pot. He goes, you're on drugs. He goes, let me see, roll up your sleeves. So, I said, roll up my sleeves? You don't shoot pot. I said, you smoke pot. And he goes, aha, how do you know? So I failed my test, obviously. I said, because of that stupid movie you showed us where everybody went, you know, became a homicidal maniac when they took a toke on, so, you know. So, I went all the way to the end. And I got to the end of 12th grade, they called me down to the office and said, we can't graduate you, you haven't been here enough. If you want a diploma, you have to go to summer school.
You want me to go to,
after 12 years of penal servitude in this system, you want me to go to summer school? You know, and this was the summer of 67, was always ever after known as the summer of love. You know, hippies, be-ins, love-ins. In-ins, out-ins, ins-outs. You know, Beatles came out with Sgt. Pepper. Jimi Hendrix came out with his first album. Cream came out with their first album. All this great shit was going on. And you want me to go to summer school? And with the more words of Jerry Lee Lewis, like, you can kiss my ass. I'm not going to Columbia University. I'm going to Columbia Records. And I didn't graduate high school. So, my mom was really upset. How are you going to get a good job? All these people I knew in school, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to make a living? I said, well, I'm going to be a musician. Come on, grow up. What are you going to grow up? You're going to play music? We think you're going to make a living as a musician? You're never going to make it. You're going to have to go out and get a real job. So, I a couple of years go by, and they start to happen. I have a couple of big records, and I start doing tours, and the tours start doing well. And I run into some of these people from the school. And they go, hey, Billy, yo, Billy, remember me, West Boulay. Hey, Billy, come here, let me ask you something, Billy, come here. What? Billy, can you lend me like $50,000? So, I tell you what, when I get a real job, maybe we'll talk about it. You know? I'm the only guy I know who's got the same job from junior high school. I have the same job. So, but my mom was brokenhearted. She was really worried. And then the school called me in 1992 and said, we want to give you a diploma. So I said, cool. I get, because I already had 2 doctorates from universities. You know, and they looked really cool on the wall. I felt like I was, you know, like when you go to a doctor's office and you check out, oh, this guy's been here, he's done that now. Cool. I used to play doctor, and now I are one. So I'm going to get complete with the series. I'll get the original high school diploma. And I go down, I do this speech. I said, I'm really glad I finally got my diploma because now I can get out of this dead end life that I'm in and really make something of myself. And but it was a lot of fun. It was class of 92, so I had the little hat with 92, and I put the thing over on the side. It was at this side, I don't remember which way it went. And everybody threw their hats up, and went, yeah, I'm a high school graduate, you know, hey, you're bad. So, yeah, it was fun. Hicksville High School. The town was called Hicksville, but the area that I lived in Hicksville was a housing development. America's first, the prototype of the first housing development in America, it was called Levittown. Hicksville, because people from New York think that they know better than anybody else. People from New York, that is real attitude, like, hey, I'm from New York, and I'm smarter than you are. Just because I'm from New York, you know? And they hear other people talk, what, you know, where are you from? Oh, well, I'm from New York. And you think, you know, because they have a different accent, they just smarter than them. But I was from New York, but I was from a town called Hicksville. So I go to like Alabama or something, you know. Where are you from? I'm from New York. Where? New York. Long Island. Where in Long Island? Hicksville! So, it was a pain in the ass. They always got fights. We're from Hicksville. Oh, Hicksville. Anyway, let me take another question. Well, it's not almost exactly the same. It is completely the same.
Did
you see who wrote that song?
No. I don't have that album. What do I do? But I don't have
okay, it. Because it says, words and music, William Joel, except chorus, L.V. Beethoven. I gave him credit.
They didn't even have copyright laws. What were we worried about?
Huh?
They didn't have copyright laws back then.
Oh, yeah. They had copyrights going way back. I mean, it's a different system. It wasn't on a computer back then. But, no, they had copyrights, and there were lawsuits about different compositions all the time. I'll show you the piece of... Okay, that song was written, let's see, it's from the Hits of the Innocent Man album, 1983. So, that was 1983. I'll tell you who was written about after I play it. It's not... A lot of people think that whole album is about Christmas. And there were some other people I was dating before. And it's like a doo-wop beginning.
Didn't I say I wasn't ready for romance? Didn't I promise we would only be friends? And so we danced, though it was only a slow dance. I started breaking my promises right there and then. Didn't you say there would be no complications? Didn't you want someone who's been there before? Now that you're here, it's not the same situation. Suddenly I don't remember the rules anymore. Here's Beethoven. This time it's only you and I. Tomorrow is a long time away. This night can last forever.
Beethoven wrote this letter to the immortal beloved. And through the whole movie, you're trying to figure out who this woman is who inspired all this great music. And this is, he's played, Gary Oldham plays Beethoven, and typically Gary Oldham's like really overplaying.
Oh,
song I wrote before I was going out with Christy, I was going out, believe it or not, with Elle McPherson, swear to God. She had just come to America, she was 19 years old, and here I find myself, I had just gotten divorced before that, and I'm going out with this. It was never going to work out. She's so much taller than I am. We walked out of holding hands. But I was really crazy about her. And I wrote that song about her. And it's interesting because Beethoven has always played a big part in my life in terms of my personal relationships. That's how I met women. That's how I met other people, was through music. When I started taking piano lessons, I was playing the John Thompson piano course. Anybody here take piano lessons? And the first book you get is the John Thompson Book One, and the first song I learned, I swear to God, it was called Off We Go to Music Land. And there's a little drawing of a little kid, you know, going into the notes, you know, Off We Go to Music Land. You know, off we go to music land, whatever, and all money and stuff. And then, for the first couple of years, I was like four when I started taking lessons. About 4 years old. Yeah, I got you. Okay. That makes a big difference. Okay. So, first couple of years, I'm really into taking piano lessons. Then I get to be about, you know, 8 or 9, 10, and I'm bored reading the notes. I don't want to read the notes anymore. I'm sick of practicing. I'm sick of taking lessons. So I start making up my own music to fake out my mom, because my mom's listening in the next room to me practice, and I have to practice. She was knowledgeable about classical music. She knew what composers were supposed to sound like. She may not have known the exact piece. But I'd say, for example, my piano teacher would, it was tough going to the piano teacher, by the way, because she also taught ballet. And in my neighborhood, walking down the street with your books to the ballet teacher was saying, kick me, hit me, beat me. Hey, Billy, where's your tutu? Boom, bang, doosh. I had to learn how to box so I could learn how to play the piano. It's kind of bizarre. Because I got tired of getting my ass kicked. So. Anyway, so I would take, so she'd give me, okay, this week I want you to learn the Mozart Sonata in C major. Now, a number of people may know this one. It's one of the more familiar Mozart pieces. Very good piece in the Middle East. Especially with Mozart and other composers of that era, was this the left hand be playing this. So I knew how to do that, so I figured, okay, my mom's listening, so I'm going to play. I'm tired of reading the dots, so I'm going to make up my own shit. Thank you.
second movement. Now, the third day, I wouldn't remember what I played the first day or the second day. Six days of complete bullshit Mozart piano pieces. And I go to the teacher at the end of the week and she said, okay, let's play the Mozart sonata in C that you were assigned to me. So I sit down, open it up. Mozart
Mr., you know, brilliant, Whitney keeps coming over to the piano and saying, can I do a song with you? Because when I get older, I want to be a singer. And Mr., you know, in total instinctive, you know, says, nah, sure, you're okay, yeah, great. No, let's do a song together. Yeah, maybe later, you know, my tongue is hanging down on my feet, you know. And then I see her a couple of years later. But I could have, I knew she if I had, you know, thinking with the little head instead of the big head. So, the Beethoven music, and specifically that song, This Night, I gave him credit. I don't think he got any money for it. I think it's a little late for that. I don't even know if there's a Beethoven family left. There is a Beethoven Foundation, which does try to protect his music, but I did give him credit. I give these guys credit. Well, money, but credit. So, let me take another question. So we'll go to house lights go up. There we go. Alrighty then. Okay, there's a young person right there in the front with a baseball hat.
Does your daughter like your songs?
That's a fair question. Yeah, I think she does. I think she does like my music. She's very musical. She writes music herself. And it's pretty good stuff. She has this great voice. She has perfect pitch. This isn't typical that my kid. She has perfect pitch. Perfect pitch is when you know what key something is in, without having to have anything that's relative to it that tells you what key it's in. She would know, we would watch Sesame Street together when she was little. She's still 10, she's still not grown up yet, but she would go, okay, I said, Sesame Street's coming on, and she'd go, Sunny Day is in the Castle. And the TV would come on, and it was, Sunny Day, in the key. I'd look at her like, whoa. And she keeps time on 2 and 4, on the backbeat, which for like, she's just a white kid. That's amazing. So why did I do that? She has instant melody retention. She hears a melody once, she remembers it, and she walks around singing all the time. I call it boombox, because I always know where she is because I can hear her singing. She's got this big Ethel Merman voice now. with this vibrato on it. So I think she likes the songs I write. Yeah, I don't know if she likes everything, and I don't sit around and ask, would you like this one? But I think she likes, I have a strange job. She's in an age right now where everything that her mom or that I do embarrasses the hell out of her. Like if I go to pick her up at school, I gotta park the car like 3 blocks away. Even if it's snowing out, just put the car 3 blocks away. Sometimes she gets worried that I'm gonna appear weird, like, I'm the only rock star father in her school, you know. So she like, tells me, dress down, you know, don't wear any like this Elton John kind of clothes. So, anyway, but I think she likes music. And she does have some particular favorites. So let me light the lights, girl. Who does that? One short. Okay, so I haven't been to up there in the nether regions. Okay, there's a guy up there. That guy, yeah, you. Yeah, okay. A little microphone going up the stairs. Little Olympic torch music.
Okay. Hello. Have you ever thought of making another album, like Songs in the Attic, with older songs that were kind of lost, like Tomorrow, Today, or The End, or something like that?
No.
Will you sing Tomorrow, Today?
No. I'm sorry. You know, that album was written, I was 21, I think. It was going through a real self-pitying time about I can hear it. I have difficulty listening to that album. I was very self-absorbed. I was contemplating my navel so much that I was like bent over double. Like too far, way deep into myself. And I'm over that. And you gotta start somewhere. I have difficulty listening to that album because it was mastered at the wrong speed. I'll give you an example of I recorded, I'm not going to play the whole thing, but I'll play part of the song. Okay, the original recording, when I played the song, it was like this. She's got a way about her. But I know that I can't live without her. She's got a way. Or maybe it was even the tape machine itself. I really never figured out how it happened. It came out speeded up. So on the record, it sounds like, she's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know what I can't live without her. And I had a listening party with all my buddies, you know, when the album first came out. And I go, okay, and I put the album on. She's got a smile on his lips. My friends will laugh. Yeah, I remember I threw it like a frisbee, you know. I was so angry, and I've always had a difficult time going back and listening. I'm not denigrating the material so much, but you can only go back from time to time. You can't dwell there. The songs on the Attic album was done just to try to show that I liked my touring band to play on the albums rather than working with session guys. Nothing wrong with session guys, but I like the way my guys play, and I wanted to redo a few songs. I'm not saying I'd never get the idea again in the future, but right now it's not something I'm thinking about. I'm writing a different kind of music right now. I'm writing instrumental music, orchestral music, piano, sonata, concerto, type music. It's very different. It's just that's my first love, and that's what I've gone back to writing. So let me take another question. There, and let's see where we're going now. What's right? How about all the way in the back there, on that, right there? Yeah, you gray top, I think.
Of all the songs you've written, what's your favorite and why?
Okay, I get asked that a lot, and it's difficult for me to just isolate one song. See, I think of these songs as my children, and I went through a metaphorical pregnancy. With a song. I don't know what it's like to be pregnant, but I know when I'm fraught with song. Oh, I hope this thing comes out soon, you know. And then and I go through a painful process of writing. I don't like writing. I love having written, I love that. But writing, I liken it to a childbirth. It's very painful. I don't enjoy the process. I don't really know what it's like to have a child. I mean, actual physical pain. Although I've had kidney stones, I understand it's kind of close. And what is it they say? Shitting a television set. So, and then afterwards, when the song is written, I actually feel a little bit depressed, like a postpartum
thing. Well, I wrote a song. Oh, I gotta do it all over again.
And so they're all my kids. And some of them grow up to be doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. Some of them grow up to be bums and dope dealers. You know? But they're all my children and I love them all. So it's difficult for me to say my favorite kid is. But each day is different. Like today, I'll probably enjoy one of the kids more than another kid for whatever reason. It's just that's the mood I'm in. But that's how that kid is seems to me. So right now, my music, what would be one of my favorite songs that I wrote? It's usually one of the later songs, because the older ones have all grown up and gone off to do what they do, and the newer ones are still little kids, and you have to pay attention to them. It's like, I love my children. You know, parents are like, I love all my kids, but look at the little one. Look at the little baby. So it would be one of the later songs. I've got to look in my book. This is, we call this the Bible. It's got another song I wrote here, lyrics, because after writing 200 songs, you start worrying about forgetting the words. Oh, what do we got? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. The last song that I wrote and recorded was actually on the last album, and it was the last song on the last album. Words are in here. I'm not going to read the words as I'm saying it. I'm just going to feel good that they're there. This is what you got to do. Hey, at least I'm not trying to bullshit you with a teleprompter or something. I got into that. I was on a tour with Elton. He had a teleprompter. And you can get hooked on it. It's, you know, you're watching your lyrics, and your lyrics have their own TV show. You know? And it really looks important. You see your words on TV, and you go, those are my words. And they're on TV. So, anyway, this is a song. I haven't done this in a while. Famous, called Famous Last Words. Someone self-fulfilling prophecy.
Stack the chairs on the tabletops. stars hang the sheets on the chandeliers. The snow's down, but it never stops. Ain't it sweet after all these years? These are the last words I have to say. It's always hard to say goodbye.
Favorite song, like right now. If you ask me that, like a half an hour later, I'll probably tell you something different. Let me think. So, if House Lights would go back up. There we go. And, okay, I begin up there. Over where?
Nosebleed.
Over there? Okay, you're pointing at somebody. You?
Nosebleed.
You, yeah.
Hi, welcome. My question has to do with producing music. I'm wondering if you plan to work with Home Alone again, or do your own stuff. How are you going to manage that?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last part of what you said.
Are you going to work with Phil Ramone again and keep producing your own stuff, or with someone else?
I like working with Phil Ramone. I had a good, long relationship with Phil. I did the albums The Stranger, 52nd Street, Glass Houses, The Songs in the Attic, The Nylon Curtain, which is still my favorite album. What else? After Nylon Curtain, An Innocent Man, The Bridge, a couple of other special project things. I stopped working with Phil only because I felt that I should try working with somebody else and try something different. I didn't want to fall into a routine. I might work with Phil again. Actually, the way we work, I really am ultimately the one who decides how I want the thing to sound, or what I do with arrangements, what I do with EQ, how the thing should be mixed. But I need somebody else who knows how to do that to bounce off of. I think sometimes you got to disagree with somebody to make the right chemistry. It's like Lennon and McCartney. It was a great songwriting team because McCartney had this very sweet melodic style and Lennon had this caustic, kind of bitter, rough edge, and the two of them together was like sweet and sour pork, you know? Sweet and sour. It's like a great combination. And so when I'm producing a record, I like to have somebody that I might actually end up arguing with about something. And if they have a better argument than me, then maybe let's try it your way. So I might work with Phil again. Yeah. It was a good relationship. Some people think that I have a problem. It was some kind of problem with our relationship. It wasn't. It was never a problem. Still are very good friends. So I'll take another question. Okay.
You don't say it! What?
Okay, let me go up into this area here up in the top of the... Okay, over there, there's somebody with this technique. Yeah, that's a high-catcher kind of trick thing. Okay, so we'll get some... Can you stand up? No, yeah, you. Yeah, stand up. So they know where to bring the mic to. So some microphone coming over to you, music.
Hi, I'd seen a documentary on you in like the early 80s, and
I just wanted to get some microphone coming over music for the next time. Okay, go ahead. Yes, I'm sorry. What was the question?
It was a documentary on you in the early 80s, and you had said future plans were to write classical music. Would you ever release an album on some of the classical, you know, tunes you were playing tonight? Would you ever release an album on classical tunes you wrote?
Well, I don't know if I would be the one. See, you may think I'm a good piano player, but I'm not as good as some of these classical guys that play at Carnegie Hall. These are really good pianists. I mean, you got to practice 6 hours a day. They live this music. day in, day out, they've spent their whole life studying to be concert virtuoso pianists. I'm not good enough to play the really good stuff. I can fake it. You start getting into Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and Chopin and Liszt, and some of these pieces are torturous to play. So I don't know if I would be the one who would play on the album. But see, I think of myself as a writer, as a composer. I always have. I don't think of myself, I see, you know, like a newspaper article, pop singer, Billy Joel, and I think, no. Pop singer, pop. I got a kid, I'm a pop, that makes me pop. I sing, all right.
Pop singer.
But I think of myself as a composer, and I would like to be able to bring music out that isn't necessarily performed by this guy, Billy Joel, because I'd like an orchestra maybe to play an orchestral piece that I've written. I'd like a concert pianist perhaps to play a piano piece that I've written, or a chorus to sing a choral piece. Should I play one of the things that's working on my own? Preface this piece, I shouldn't really have to explain it, but I'm going to. I want it to be played by an orchestra that plays a hymn. I don't know, there were orchestral hymns. One of them is like the Navy hymn, Sailor hymn. Anyway, there's a part in this that is taken from an old lullaby called Mighty Like a Rose. You know the song Mighty Like a Rose? No? Okay. It goes, this little baby, everybody knows. Don't know what to call her, but she's mighty like a rose. No, you've never heard the song. Nobody ever sang it. But some people heard. Okay. Anyway, there's a piece of that in this, so you don't think I'm stealing. I'm giving anonymous credit, whoever it was. But well, anyway, so this is I call this an elegy. I'm gonna use a sound that's supposed to sound like an orchestra.
Thank you.
To me, it sounded like a hymn. I was writing it as it would be like something you hear in church. Or there's a couple of hymns that are orchestral hymns. You know, there's a Taylor's hymn. They played it at the funeral for John F. Kennedy. They folded up the flag and handed it to Jackie. And the whole nation just went, oh. And they played this very small dirge-like hymn, and it goes, gentleman behind you, when I called, yeah, this guy looked a little disappointed because he thought I might have been him, so I don't want to have too many disappointed.
I know about a lot of this guy listening to, I get a feeling that that person who wrote the music had some sort of, they're inspired by some event that were in, and one of the songs that he wrote was The Night Side Down, that is in some way, somehow, being experienced in that time period during Vietnam, and it inspired me with it. Did you get a really emotion from that song that you were affected by that?
Yeah, I was. I didn't go and fight in Vietnam. A lot of my friends did. It was my generation's war, whether we, you know, were there fighting or whether we protesting, or it had an effect on everyone's life. And I was ripe to go. I was draftable. They had a lottery, and I just missed getting drafted. A lot of my friends went. I come from a neighborhood where a lot of guys, just as soon as I got out of high school, went right into the Marines, right into the Army, right into the Navy. And a lot of them got very traumatized by their experience in Vietnam. Now, after that war was done, after they did their tour of dirty duty and came home, they weren't encouraged to talk about their experiences. That was a very unpopular war. And they were never really welcomed home, like the veterans who came back from World War II were given these parades, and everybody was deliriously happy, and it was supposed to be a good war that we fought. But then after that, the Korean War, those guys got screwed too. They never got welcomed home. And it had a very negative impact on them. They weren't welcomed home. So one night I was sitting around with these friends of mine who had been there. I wasn't there. It's not right. I can't write the song. I said, we'll tell you what to write. We'll tell you how we felt. We'll tell you what happened. And you write this song. And I thought about it, and then I realized it was the best book written about the Civil War. The Red Badge of Courage, my mind being the best book about the Civil War, was written by a guy who didn't even fight in the Civil War, Stephen Crane. There was another famous book written by Upton Sinclair about the Civil War, and you'd think he was there, but he hadn't been there. Eric Maria Remarque wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. He wasn't there. So I thought, okay, if these guys could do that, let me give it a shot. And I wrote it and I showed it to them. I said, is this okay? And they actually corrected me on a few things, some technical things, and but they're the ones who inspired me to write that song. It was essentially, I didn't want to write a political song. I didn't want to make a political statement. I wanted to write about how soldiers felt, because that's the most effective anti-war statements of all is ask a soldier what it's like to face death. Ask him what it's like, what they felt like. And that ultimately becomes the biggest thing to a statement you can make.
So that's what inspired that song. Let me take another question. Okay, right in front here, this guy. Waiting for the microphone.
First of all, thank you for your music. I just want to thank you from all of us. Elton John at the Meadowlands, and you said that was, recorded that night for an album. Is that album still coming out, or?
Well, it was being recorded. We recorded a bunch of the shows. The problem with putting out an album of that was he was on one record company, moving to another record company, and I was on a completely different third record company. So you're talking about three sets of lawyers here. Which is like a cluster, you know what I mean? You're like, you're not two sets of lawyers maybe. Three sets of lawyers, forget about it. Two's company, three's a crowd. So it was impossible for them to work it out, but it's not something that's out of the question in the future. Elton and I have written a song together. We haven't recorded it yet, because we haven't figured out what label would put it out and how we could distribute it. It's all kind of silly, but it would be stupid for us not to try to do something. So we'll think of something. But that was a fun tour. I had a blast doing that tour. I was on the road for 2 years on my last tour. You know, people might know that I showed up here at one time, Landover I played, and then I played Philly, and then we were like gone. So, but I didn't just like go home and go to sleep. You know, I went all around the world and was 2 years of touring. I got burnt out on the road. I didn't get back. Actually, I've been home now for almost a year from the last tour. So it was a long tour because we started in 93. And at Elton, I did two tours with Elton, and that was a lot of fun. I remember the first night, I had this grand piano, like 9 foot grand. He has a 9 foot grand, all the way back there. So, and I'm sitting there, I'm like 18 feet of piano away from me. Is Elton? I'm thinking, this is so cool. And we would start, you know.
This is a little bit funny. Feeling inside, 'cause I wanna lose you easily. I always thought this part was fun. I don't have much money. Oh, but if I did, I wouldn't look at him on this part. I'd buy a big house with a people would live.
You know, you read all this stuff about celebrities, and from reading what I read about Elton, I didn't know what he was going to be like. I knew that I liked his music, that I thought it would be great for an audience to see Elton and I together, because I, you know, two piano players, you know, he's English and American. No, he's one sexual persuasion of another one. You know, let's get on stage and let's do it. And we had a good time. Reverse people here. Anyway, I mean, he's a wonderful man, and I read all this crazy stuff in the press. I didn't know. I thought, I bet you he's gonna be temperamental, and you know, he'll be throwing a hissy fit every 5 minutes, you know. He was professional, he was always on time, he was clean and sober. He is a great piano player, much better than I even thought he was. He was kicking my ass some nights playing his hand, and I'd be going, whoa, and he kind of pushed me to play him better. And he was very, very nice. He has a very good heart. And I had a birthday when I was in London, turned 45 when we started the tour, and I was in London, and he threw this big birthday party for me. And I was going through the divorce with Christie. It was a drag time for me. And he went out of his way to do this. Now, the British are very serious about their parties, you know. They're very, you know, when they throw a soiree, it's mid, you know, to do die for. So I'm in the middle, it's in the middle of this park in London, in this pavilion, and he invites all the hoi polloi from London. There's Eric Clapton is there, Seal is there, everybody who was, Tim Rice was there, Roger Moore, all these movie stars and rock stars. And I'm sitting there at a table with Elton John and Eric Clapton, and right next to me is Joan Collins, you know? Well, I'm thinking, this is a cool party. You know, I'm checking out the work sheet I've done, you know? I did a good job. And I'm looking across the room now. I was single again, and across the room was this beautiful girl. She was dressed in this outfit like Marilyn Monroe. She wore this Marilyn Monroe style outfit. She looked like Marilyn Monroe. I found out later she was a singer called Kim Wilde. I didn't know who she was. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking, and I finally turned to Elton. And Elton was at the table. His band was there. Davy Johnson was there. Ray Cooper. And they're all, you know, great guys. And I turned to Elton, and I looked across this crowd, and I said, Elton, who is that beautiful blonde over there? And he looks over and he goes, oh, that's my guitar player, David Johnston. So I said, never mind. Just forget it. Right? So and he's really a kind and thoughtful and caring person, and I'm proud to call him one of my friends. It was a good tour, and I'll work with him again. We'll definitely work with him. Probably gonna back in England tell them heterosexual stories about me. So let me take another question. Okay, where were we? We were over here. We have been there. Now we should go into the back again. Okay. Where? Okay. That all the way in the corner, the worst seat in that section. The corner, the last. Yes, you. Yep. The nosebleed of all nosebleeds.
My name is Jackie Webb. I'm a professional in the music business. I currently started my career working at CD manufacturing at disc makers. And forgive me, I manage a local band called Special Figure. My question to you is, what is the best advice you can give someone starting out in the music business?
Okay. Do these people write their own material?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good thing to do, is to have original material. The hardest thing to sustain a career in music is to come up with new songs. You can sing great, you can play great, you can look great on a video. If you don't have material that's good, you may have one hit, but then, you know, you have to depend on other people for your material, and that will ultimately be detrimental. I would say to try to be as self-sufficient as you can be. I would encourage them to write. I would also encourage them to copyright the material as soon as they write it, and don't send me a tape. Also, I would tell them that they should, someone should on a regular basis meet with whoever the people are who are handling the money and be satisfied about what's happening with their money. Okay? Because I'm not saying you might be a dishonest person. My experiences have been, for the most part, with management, bad. Okay, I can't pick them, you know what I mean? I've had a lot of bad experiences. I've been cleaned out many times. Because as a musician, I'm not business oriented. I'm not money oriented. I'm art. I'm off of my ivory tower making my music. And, you know, give me some money, a couple of hundred in the pocket, okay, I'll go buy some food now, okay?
Yeah.
And I'll go to, you know, Armani, and they give me my clothes for nothing now. Now that I got the money to afford it, they don't want my money. You know? It's kind of whacked. So where were you when I didn't have money? You know? No, we don't have no. No, it's okay. I have money. We want you to go to school. So that would be another piece of advice I would give someone. Keep an eye on the books. Somebody, if you are going to be managing a group, be as forthcoming as you can be with them. Educate them, whether they want to hear it or not. They should know. They should be aware of the facts of life in terms of finance. We live in a capitalist society. There are plenty of sharks who are willing to take money from people who don't watch out for their own money. So you have to make a living. You have to be able to protect what you've earned. The other piece of advice I would give someone starting out is when you begin to make money, you should really, you know, I hate things, it's like taking, Louis Pasteur figured it out. You give somebody a dose of rabies so they don't get rabies. So, a vaccination. But they should do, of course it's a vaccination, but I mean, I don't know what that process is. You kind of get a dose of the disease so you don't really get the disease. Immunization. Immunize. Thank you. Songwriter with a big vocabulary, right? Immunization. You get immunized. What they'll have to do is they start to make money, get a lawyer. Okay? And then, when they start making more money, get another lawyer to watch the first lawyer. And I'm not saying everybody here is an attorney or studying law. You might be a great guy or gal, you know, if you end up representing me in my next lawsuit, whatever that's going to be. But you need good legal advice and accounting. I know it has nothing to do with music. It's the music business. And we are in the music business. Music business is larcenous, corrupt, crooked. My tour manager does this just to remind me when I'm yakking so much. Try to work. I mean, then all the jobs that become available may not be the most prestigious type of jobs, but the more work you do, the better you'll get. I started out in bands. A lot of people think I was in piano bars all my life. I was only in a piano bar for 6 months while I was hiding out from another manager, you know, to get out of a bad contract. But I worked in all kinds of situations. I did Sweet 16s, I did bar mitzvahs, I did parties, I did church dances, I did mafia weddings, you know. Those were fun. Those people party. And we didn't have to walk in the back door. They let us go in the front door like everybody else. And you know, but it was the same rubber chicken, you know. So what was the other thing? Okay, work. I used to be the opening act. I was the opening act for the Beach Boys for a year. You want to talk about a fun gig? You know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, lots of fun. 20,000 people every night. Beach Boys, Beach Boys, Beach Boys. And now, to open the show.
Beach Boys. Open?
Somebody else is here. Beach Boys, Beach Boys, Beach Boys. And I go on, you know, doing my little piano man thing. And boom! Sack! Boom! California girls! Little news too! Good vibrations! Boom! 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 Now, after a year of that, you get really good. I was the opening act of the Doobie Brothers. That was a fun one. Whoa, whoa, listen to the music. Boogie, boogie, and now to open the show. Open? Open the show? Billy?
Get off the stage, Major.
But I took a lot of those gigs, and then after a while, we started getting better than the headliner. We learned all these cheap tricks. We learned how to... I started writing better music. That's one of the cheap tricks. I started getting good at being on stage, being a good performer. The band got better. We got tighter. We were throwing off tours. I remember we were on the tour. I was the opening act, get this, for Olivia Newton-John. Who put this together, Snow White and Lenny Bruce. She come out as people, I thought I was in a church. People just sitting out there, they had like white gloves on their hands. And I go all these Sunday go to meeting folks, and I come out, hey, how you doing? So we got thrown off on tour that we did something nasty in our dressing room. So let's see, what else? I was the opening act for the Eagles. Yes, the opening act for Yes. A lot of bands. I opened up for a lot of different groups, and we got good at it. So take the work that you can get, work as much as you can, and like I said, be as open as you can be with these musicians that you're working with about the business of things. They have to know. They need to know. So, let me take another question. Look at this. I got one of these things. I don't know if you can see this. Does that work? Doesn't even work anymore. Well, so much for that. Hey, Max, what's Max? Max is here. It's this little laser pointer. It's supposed to help me isolate people in the audience. But I always wonder, you know, like, could this, like, cut people in half? So I'm always afraid to use it. You know, with my luck, I'll point it right in some lawyer's eye. And then I'll get a letter, you know, do we cheat him enough? You know, Peter McGill. No, it doesn't work. All right, so I was up there. Now I should go towards a medium middle type of thing. Okay, right here in the back. Yeah, right there. No, next to the front, in front of you. There, you. Yeah. Believe it or not, really.
Is it true that you won't or can't play Uptown Girl?
That I won't or can't play Uptown Girl? No, that's not true. It's not true. That's correct. Not the whole thing, because that is in a high key. I wrote that song.
Anyone with hot blood can, and now she's looking for a downtown man. That's what I am. Whoa, whoa. I wrote
wrote that in 1983, 13 years ago, and my voice was kind of higher back then. You could hit the high notes. So 1983, so I was 33, 34. I could hit all these great high notes. When you get older, I'm 46 now, you lose the high end.
But you gain a little bit of things. I kind of like it, like that Barry White area, you know? Oh, baby. Oh, baby.
The reason that I stopped doing the song, it had to do with the thing with me and Christy. It was just so high, I'd get to that point in the night where we would do that song, and I'd go, G minor, G-minor, shh! This is such a high key. I was trying to sound like Frankie Valli from the Four Seasons. You know the Four Seasons? Four Seasons, before the Beatles came out, quite possibly might have been the biggest band in America. They did all the Ailey's hits. Sherry, Sherry baby, Sherry baby.
Sherry baby.
Big girls don't cry. Big girls. Frankie Valli sang with his high voice. It sounds like when he's singing, somebody's got their hand right around him. Sherry baby.
Sherry baby.
Which is why I wonder if Michael's grabbing himself like that all the time. Give that sound, that Frankie Valli did. But there was one song that the Four Seasons did I never really understood. The premise of the song, this is the premise of the song. This kid is having problems with his girlfriend. So he goes to his father, and dad's gonna give him good advice. And his father tells him, forget about her, break up with her, you'll find somebody else. You gotta walk like a man. You gotta talk like a man.
Walk like a man, talk like a man, walk like a man, my son.
And I can see the kids sitting there going, walk like a man, sing like a girl. Thanks, Dad. So, interesting. So, anyway, let me take another question. But no, I'm not saying I'll never do that song again. It's just, wherever you were, I don't know where I was. It's high. It's like people who sing these songs in high keys, like Sting. Okay, Sting's what, 44 right now.
Roxanne, you don't have to put a rest tonight. I've told you once, I won't tell you again. Say about it tonight.
I'm thinking, a couple of years, man, he's going to be going, Roxanne, you don't have to, but then again, you never know. He's into this yoga thing, right? You know what I mean? He's into this yoga, and he's always meditating, and maybe these yogi people can sing those high notes when they get old. But yeah, he says he can make love for 8 hours, too. I don't know about that. As a yoga, you can make love for 8 hours. I don't know if I want to do that for 8 hours. I don't want to do anything for 8 hours. Okay, let's see. Why Fermo? What? Because you waited in line? You guys waited in line? Oh, wait. I want to find this guy. See, you got the front row because you waited in line. In the snow. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right, that's fair enough. I'll tell you why. Because for years, when I would look in the front row, I would see people who had bought scalp tickets. Usually it was scalp tickets. I knew that people who were really fans and waited in line in the cold would get shut out of getting tickets. It happens, still happens all the time. And you'd hear all the real fans would always be in the back going, hey, and I look in the front row. Now we got a fan war going on. No, but you know how it works. The scalpers try to get all the front row tickets. Somehow or another, with these unscrupulous music business ticket agency people, somehow all the good tickets seem to disappear. Now, how did that happen? Right? And they all go to these fat cat ticket buyers. You know, you look down the front row, and there's this guy with the gold chains and a big cigar. And he's not a real fan. He's just there. All right, gentlemen, entertain me. You know, he's not going to rock out. He's going to sit there and not... I paid $5,000 for this ticket, and I'm not moving a hair on my body. And he's sitting next to his babe, you know, with the big bouffant hair, you know. Hey, what about these tickets, son? You wanted to go see this guy? What's his name? Billy Joe? There he is. All right, gentlemen, all right. Entertain me. So I'd see year after year all these scalp tickets in the front. I really got mad. So about 1980, okay, about 15, 16 years ago, I got fed up. It was around Christmas time. We're in New York. We're doing a gig at, like, the Garden, Madison Square Garden. I say, don't sell the front row seats. Don't put the front row tickets on sale. I do not want anybody to be able to scalp the front row seats. And everybody got nervous, because they couldn't make their little extra cash by scalping them. So we held the tickets. I sent the road crew out. It was right around Christmas time. Dressed as Santa Claus and the elves. And they went to the back seats, to the worst seats in the house, and gave the tickets to the worst seats. Now those people, they're in the front row, and of course there was a little hesitant at first, because, you know, New Yorkers, they're suspicious of anything. Some elf comes up to you and goes, here's front row seats. So, and they were like, you're right. What am I supposed to do for these front row seats? But they finally did get the picture. They came up and they were thrilled, and they're hugging each other and jumping up. Hey, front row! High five! Front row! They were rocking out. It made for a better show that the real fans got the seats, because we're looking down and saying, hey. Over too much time, you start getting depressed, but you realize how larcenous the business is. All the people who can afford to pay scalp ticket prices get the best seats. The fans get screwed. And the people who paid for the front row seats get screwed for having to pay that much money. And I get screwed because I put a under $30 on my ticket. I never charge more than that. I try to keep the ticket price down. So everybody's getting screwed by these bastards, right? So. Now, the road crew still to this day, we do not put the front row seats whenever I do a concert. You can't buy front row seats. You only can get given front row seats. Over the years, the crew, depending on who it is in the crew, has front row tickets. He might give them to somebody who happens to catch his fancy. You know. So, some nights I'll look down and I'll see all these, you know, great-looking women dressed in these little halter tops and short skirts and high heels and stuff. And, you know, And that doesn't hurt the show either. Okay. You know, I look down and I go, this is really like a great looking audience. So I'm on the road with Elton, and I say to Elton, we don't put the front rows on sale. We don't put the front seats on sale. He was totally into it. He got the whole point. He says, cool. I go, this way the scalpers can't get the seats, so we're doing stadiums. So the first three rows is a lot of seats in the stadium. So we split it down the middle. Okay, these are the seats I'm going to have. These are the seats you're going to have. So we're playing everything. And we're starting the show, and he's looking over to my side. He sees all these women all dressed up, great-looking women in the front. And he's looking. And then one night, I can swear, I see a little light bulb go up over his head. And the next night, this whole section, all the front rows are just cute little boys. It's a little bit. This show got a lot better too. Let's take another question. Okay, so I was the front row, okay, because you people suffered the most. You gave. You suck. Okay, the guy with the generic way to wear the baseball.
You have a couple questions?
No. One per customer.
Question. Well, I wanted to hear you play piano, man. Woo! I also know what that piece of paper is, because you keep taking it out of your pocket.
You want to know what the piece of paper is?
Okay.
It says, talk about scalpers. Because I always forget to do that. They're going to drive us off the road. Scalpers are going to drive a lot of my contemporaries just off the road. We're sick of it. We're sick of people getting ripped off. Okay, what else? Voter registration. Start composing, going to Cairo. That's just my little notes to myself. I got a Potsky with something. You know, it's Potsky. But it's just notes to myself. I think it's got somebody's phone number on it. It was done on the road, so it must have been a good phone number. I hate that. There's no name next to it. Did you hate that? You know, you write the phone number down, and it's like unattached to somebody's face. No, you don't want this phone number. Okay, let me take a question. So I was in the front row, and I'll be back in the front row. Come back. So, okay, middle, okay, right there, there's somebody, you right there. There's two people next to each other. There's one leaning that way, and there's one with two hands up. Okay, the two-handed up person, right? No, don't put too far up. Come on back, two steps. Right there, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I was wondering who you wrote Shameless for. Do you have any
in
mind or
anything like that? Okay, Shameless. Let me think. Actually, the style of the song the lyrics. See, I'm Shameless when it comes to love. I'll do anything you want me to. I'll do anything at all. It's obviously a husband trying to get out of the doghouse with a wife. Yeah, so it was Christy, probably. Look, if anybody's married, you get those doghouse things happen. Let me see. But I was thinking of Jimi Hendrix when I wrote the song. I love Jimi Hendrix. And I wanted to write a Hendrix type of song. So, anybody got any gum? Got a piece of gum? Chewing gum, huh?
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix. He was so cool, he just sang when he was chewing gum. So, I'm trying to think. I know what a good Hendrix song is.
Who's ever been
insecure about the world I've been living in. I don't break easy, I have my pride, but if you need to be satisfied, I'm shameless. So, Garth Brooks does this song, right? Give birth to this thing, I'm thinking, hey, it's like Hendrix. And the kid grows up and it becomes this country western star. What album was that on? It was on Stormfront, 89. I was married to Christy. Probably in the doghouse, and I was trying to get out. Here, one song. Can I get out now? So, and take another question. Okay, so I was here. I should go up there now. Where? Okay, right. I haven't been there. Yeah, you're pointing to yourself. It was the pressure that really made me
write it. So not being able to write creates a lot of pressure. So, okay, now I'm just there.
Alan Pan has been a special song to me, and I wondered what inspired you to write that song.
Okay. I started writing that song back in the 70s, actually. We used to work a lot in the Lehigh Valley. There's a lot of schools. There was Lehigh College, Northampton, Muhlenberg. We would play at this was a place called the Roxy, I think was another name. And we would always stay at that little Howard Johnson's on the Double Deuce in Allentown. And it looked, you know, it was a Howard Johnson, but it made believe it was a ski chalet. But, you know, it's just as if this day, this is not a ski, this is such bullshit. It's a Howard Johnson. They had the high ceiling, you know, trying to make you believe you're in a Rocky Mountain ski chalet. So I started writing this. I remember we played there a lot. It was kind of a bread and butter area for, I gotta get rid of the gun. Okay, so I remember one of the last times we played there, we were starting to become nationally successful. I think the Stranger album had come out, and I remember this young guy coming up to us as we were leaving. He goes, "You're never coming back here again." And I said, "What do you mean, you're never coming back here?" Because anybody who gets really big, they never come back here again. They always play the major cities. They never come back to Allentown. So I said, "Well, I'll be back. I'll come back." Of course, I never did. No, actually, I did. And it always bothered me, this thought of this guy watching, you know, they had put us through college, and here we were going off, and we weren't going to see them anymore. And I really felt bad about what he said. And it stayed in my mind, Allentown. Now, I originally had started writing a song that I called Levittown. Because that's where I was from, Levittown. But it ended up being, I had the music, I started writing words, but where I grew up, there wasn't a whole lot going on. So I started writing. Shoot it than I do with some songs. I put it in the spare parts bin. It's where, you know, you put your old carburetors and, you know, gas pumps and manifolds and exhausts. And sometimes it matches. Well, I think I can put this on. Yeah, it works. So, and then I picked up a newspaper, and this was in the early 80s, 82 it was, and I read about the steel industry's financial, economic woes. The United States steel industry was going down a crapper, and the Rust Belt was beginning to emerge. And these young people who thought they were guaranteed to get at least as far as their parents did, to do at least as well as their parents did, no longer had that promise anymore. The endless horizon of bountiful, endless prosperity in America had been shut down. And it was a different world. The world was different now. You didn't have the guarantees that you were going to do as well as your parents did. And I said, "That's what I'm going to write about. Allentown. Allentown has a real American name. It's like Bobby Town, Jimmy Town, Allentown." we're kind of getting into the shank of the evening here. Is it supposed to rain on the weekend?
Let's go!
So it'll be 70 tomorrow? Excellent. Okay, let me call the front row because I said I'll call the front row. Okay, yeah, right, got it. The weather lady.
First, I want to say that your amazing energy and our team many times. I was wondering, I saw you a couple years ago on New Year's Eve at Nassau Coliseum, and I was wondering whether you liked to play on New Year's Eve, and why, and I was wondering whether I'd shake your hand.
Well, man, we tried before.
We ain't perfect,
right? So let's see, Nassau Coliseum, New Year's Eve. Well, here's the thing. To me, New Year's Eve, when I was a lot younger, I used to do all the stupid stuff you do on New Year's Eve. And I got to the conclusion, I came to the conclusion that New Year's Eve really is kind of like amateur night, you know? Everybody gets stupid on New Year's Eve. And then you wake up in a brand new year feeling like shit. And I thought, this is not a good way to start a new year. So why not work? We might as well work. So I usually end up working on New Year's Eve. It's close to home, and I like being as close to home as I can be now, because I got really homesick on the way up to work. I would be, and you know, they keep me I'm in these nice hotels, but at night, it's not your pillow, you know? I like my pillow. I just like my pillow. And I look up, and it's that same cottage cheese ceiling. You're laying there, you know, I call it hotelitis. And then, there's that ceiling. That's not my pillow. I want to go home. And it's been like 30 years of that. So, New Year's Eve we work. And we usually work in New York. I'm becoming like the new Guy Lombardo, I guess, you know. We do all that inside and all that stuff. And I watch everybody else make fools of themselves. So it's fun. Okay, so let me take just a few more questions, and then we'll kind of wrap it up down here. Where's the light? Okay, good. There you. Squeaky wheel gets the grease. Microphone coming over there, it is on the squeak.
How does Summer Highland Falls get its name?
Summer Highland Falls got its name. I wrote the song, it was summer, and I was living in Highland Falls. But there's nowhere in the song where it says Summer Highland Falls. Now let me just look at the lyric and it'll maybe jog my memory as to why I wrote Summer Highland Falls. Well, a lot of T's, a lot of S's. Okay, I like that. No, okay, I think why the lyrics are about confronting the possibility of life isn't going to be perfect, the relationship you're having with somebody is not, the honeymoon is over, that things may not work out, things, people go their different ways, there are problems. When you take off the rose-colored glasses, it's about disappointment and being able to accept it. And there's an element of, it's screaming, manic depressive. because it's either, it's the word that keeps coming back, it's either sadness or euphoria. So this is a raving manic depressive writing this. And the music in it, the music mirrors what that is the sadness and euphoria. The bass part, I'll play a little bit of it here. The bass notes go up, and the melody goes down, and the right hand keeps playing movement, so there's always motion. So it goes,
they're the only times I've ever known.
sympathize. I can only stand at the bar and sympathize. But we don't always put our situations hand us to the sadness or euphoria.
Companies. I don't think about friends. I don't think about anybody else but little me. That's all I think about. It's not very selfish, but I just do it purely for my own entertainment. I have a short attention span. And I have to do things to amuse myself. So I write for me, and I write just so maybe it's something I want to hear. Maybe it's something I want to do with some musicians and the people that I work with, and that's pretty much it. And I think I know, the thing is, I know how to play the instrument. I'm not a virtuoso, but I know how to play it. I know how to write music. I know how to write lyrics. And I know how to go on a stage and perform for an audience. So I feel like I'm competent. I don't think I'm extraordinary, I think I'm competent. But in an age of incompetence, that makes me extraordinary.
I'm not saying that there's no other 50, but there's plenty of good young bands out there. There's a lot of good groups. I think Bush is a good group. I like Pearl Jam. I think Tori Amos is a good group. There's a lot of good people, but a lot of people don't know how to do what they're supposed to do anymore. How many people here had any work done on your house? Right? See, when I was a kid, a guy came over, he was going to work on my house. Olaf, the Swede, whoever it was, you know, Sven would come over, and he put a couple of nails in, and that was it, and that thing stayed there forever. Now people, they come over to my house, they don't know what they're doing. I don't know. Maybe we should put it over here. And it never works, and they charge me up the yin-yang. That's the downside of being famous. Giorgio Armani don't want my money, but the plumbing contractor really wants my money. it's just incompetence drives me crazy. It drives me nuts. The people just don't know how to do what they're supposed to do. So I would say to people, especially in college, figure out as soon as you can what it is you love. Find out what you love. And do that. You can actually make a living out of what you love. Hey, you know, like if you love sex, you know, maybe you'd be a prostitute or a gigolo, I don't know. But just be good at it. Because if you're doing what you love, you'll be better at what you're doing. Because you'll spend more time at it. You'll have an affection for it. You'll care for it. You take your work home with you, you know? I'm not just talking about the Smodoroka thing. But I was very lucky. I found out what I loved at age 14. I knew I was going to be a musician. I knew I was going to be a musician when I was a little kid, when I was first taking piano lessons at 4. This is what I want to do. I want to be a musician. I didn't know how yet. Then I saw the Beatles on TV. And they weren't made in Hollywood. They were regular working class guys. They wrote their own songs. They played their own instruments. They had this whole other kind of attitude. They combed their hair like girls, you know? And their hair really wasn't that long. We thought their hair was so long. It was just like regular greaser's hair combed down, you know? And we thought, wow, that's cool, eh? That took a lot of guts, you know? Comb your hair like a girl, you know? Because in my neighborhood, you comb your hair like a girl, they beat the shit out of you. These guys, when they played, I said, that's cool. That's a great job. And then I played right after the Beatles came out in America. I was in a band. I played at a church dance, Holy Family Church. I'm up on stage, I'm 14 years old. We're playing Beatles songs. Oh, yeah, that is something. It sounded great. It's cool. I'm looking down, and Virginia Callahan is actually looking at me. Virginia, for a moment, a good day young. Virginia. She's actually looking at me. She would never look twice at me before. And I'm thinking, and then at the end of the night, the priest gives us each $15, which in 1964 was like $15,000, you know? And I said, you mean you get paid for doing this? I'm in. This is it. This is what I'm doing. This is what I love. And that's what I did from then on. So, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I know how to do the job. So maybe that's why I've been able to hang in there. But I don't really do it thinking about anybody else except my own silliness. So let me take one more question.
No, please! Come on, go up here!
I don't know what to do. You don't know me just the way I am. I don't know what to do. Who will he call on? Over here, maybe, no, maybe over there. Okay, I haven't been in this section. Right there. Okay, you. Yes. Okay, no pressure. Just the last question of the night.
Well, I love this song. What was your inspiration for Lullaby?
Lullaby? It was, no, I'm going to see her tomorrow. So it's my daughter, my little girl. It was about 3 years ago. She was going to sleep. You know, children, at night, they get very philosophical. My little girl would always get into these deep profound conversations with me when I was putting her to bed. And children are afraid to go to sleep at night because it's dark and their imagination, can scare them. And they want you to stay with them and they want to talk about things that trouble them, things that are meaningful to them. And a kid can make you feel like God. You know, the kid puts their little hand in yours and they trust you to walk them across the street and you stop traffic. And it's so great feeling. I dig this God trip, like I'm God. And God is this child. And she thinks I know the answers. She asks questions, and I have to give her the right answers to these questions. So she asked me one night, what happens when you die? And I thought, oh, this is a big one. I got to get the right answer for this. And actually, and her and her mother and I were going to split up. And my parents split up, and I wanted her to know that I wasn't going to leave her. No matter what, I was going to see her, because I didn't see my dad. But I was going to see her, and I wanted to tell her, I will never leave you. I will never leave you. And that, and it kind of dovetailed into this idea of what happens when you die. If you're close enough, and immortality, you go from this life into another person's heart. If you keep, if someone's in your heart, then they're alive. Even if they passed on, they're still alive. I mean, to me, Beethoven is still alive. His music is as meaningful and relevant now as it ever was. And that was 200 years ago. And it was a way for me to explain to her, I didn't want her to fear, you know, to go into this big panic about dying, because I think everybody does it one time in their life. Isn't there a way to beat this? Isn't there a way around it? And when it hits a child, the enormity of it is, no, that's it, the end of the line. And I really believe that you go into somebody else's heart, and that's what I was trying to explain in that song for my kid, and I wrote her a lullaby. That's what inspired that song. So let me take another question. One more question. One more chance. Okay. Right over. Right there. Yeah. Okay. The person with the rooting section. The people pointing at you. Okay. Yes. We'll wait a little.
Hi. I just want to ask you, you talk a lot about going into classical music, but I think some of your music tends to have a blues sound to it, and I'm wondering if you enjoy the blues and if you're planning on ever doing anything like that or exploring that.
I like blues. My favorite singer, maybe of all time, is Ray Charles. And that's music that I admire a great deal. I find it hard for me to try to sing too many blues songs. You know, it's like if I was not me, I'd be listening to me going, what the hell's he complaining about? What do you mean you got the blues? He's married frankly. You know, he's got $1 million, he's got a big successful career. Lose my ass. there's a certain, now everybody gets the blues, everybody's entitled to get the blues. It crosses racial lines, it crosses ethnic lines, economic lines. I mean, you can have divinity of, what was that, the white middle class blues? It was a really good blues. Let's see, this would be my blues.
Oh, I woke up this morning.
Don't.
CCR don't work no more.
No, I love listening to blues, and I love, sometimes I try to sing like Ray Charles because I just love his voice so much, and I try to not sound like this kid from Levittown. I want to sound like a black man from Georgia, you know. But I'm not. I'm this white kid from Levittown, so, but I it doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying. So, you know, we all get the blues, and I think there's an element of the blues in some of the lyrics I wrote, maybe even more than the music. So, and I didn't respond to this guy's. This guy has a question. Village in the 60s, yep, it was the early 60s, and I saw Bob Dylan, and he had this thing on his neck. And it was the first time I saw Dylan, I thought, what happened to that guy's neck? You know? And then I heard him sing, and I went, oh, it's not his neck, it's his throat.
Song tonight. out for a Saturday, and the manager gives me a smile, cause he knows that it's me they've been coming to see, to forget about life for a while. Sing us a song.